The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. With those words from Gramsci, I welcome you to the Time of Monsters podcast. I'm GT of the Nation magazine, which is the sponsor of the podcast. So this week, as often in the past, we're going to like turn towards the Middle East and American foreign policy, and in particular, what seems like the cusp of another major war. So once again, welcome. Friend of the program, frequent guest, Matt Duss.
Foreign policy correspondent for the program.
a storied figure, often advisor to progressive policy.
Storied, wow. Okay.
On these matters. So, Matt, do you, I mean, let's just get sort of started. Like, where are we sort of standing now? I know there's like a huge, I think what Trump has called a vast armada that's in the Middle East, and which is like I think one reason it's all for concern, because it's like the biggest military buildup since the invasion of Iraq in 2002-2003.
Right, yeah. For once, Trump isn't lying. Yeah. I mean, there is a vast armada. This is, as you said, the biggest buildup of U.S. military force in the region in over two decades, since the lead up to the Iraq war. And what's concerning is, like, it's very hard to imagine that this a force of this size and all the resources and time it took to assemble it will not be used, right? Yeah. This is, you know, perhaps the biggest Chekhov's gun in Act One that the world has ever seen, and it's very, unfortunately, very likely that gun will be fired in future acts. Trump, you know, again, this is, you know, Trump started to talk about this a few months ago. We had, of course, the June war, the 12-day war that Israel launched against Iran last June, and Trump, you know, came in for a couple days of bombing of Iranian nuclear facilities, declared that Iran's nuclear program had been obliterated. This was, of course, false, and obviously false at the very beginning. But now we know it's false because they are back to warning that Iran could have a nuclear weapon very soon. But, you know, Trump, there's no consistency here. Trump just lies about that before, and he's lying about it now. But of course, and the fact that these two lies are in complete contradiction doesn't really matter. What matters is that the U.S. is on the precipice of another illegal and very, very stupid and likely very disastrous war.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of think a little bit through, like, in terms of, like, what Trump is maybe thinking. Because, I mean, I think what we have seen in the last decade is that he has a kind of preference for, you know, brutal displays of force, but has been wary of, like, long protracted wars. But I mean, this is, like, shaping up to be, you know, the exact thing that he actually, like, has consistently run against, which is the kind of forever wars with boots on the ground. I mean, or, you know, like, possibility of large American casualties. And I think that there's been some reporting that he told the Pentagon, you know, he'd like to see, like, no American casualties, and they told them, you know, quite realistically, we can't guarantee that, like, what exactly, in terms of, like, mapping out Trump's own thinking about this, like, it does seem like he's been, he's put himself in a position where he's, like, going forward with the exact type of war that, you know, for all his flaws, he has tried to avoid.
Yeah. I mean, well, let's back up and just understand what is driving this. What is the urgency here? It is not the nuclear program, because even though their nuclear program was not obliterated, as Trump claimed, it was damaged considerably. Iran still has a large amount of highly enriched uranium. It's unclear what ability they have to process it. But that is not the urgency here. And I hate, and I have bad news about, you know, the plight of the Iranian people, who have been, you know, protesting for weeks, some of the largest protests in the history of the Iran, this, you know, the Islamic Republic, and being killed and repressed in absolutely brutal and horrific ways. Donald Trump doesn't care about that. It should be abundantly clear. He doesn't care about that. What is driving this is Iran's reconstitution of its ballistic missile arsenal, which is to say a huge part of this is being driven by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his government, because that is a main concern of Israel. Even I was in Israel back in October, and even then heard from Israeli analysts, which is just, you know, a few months after the June war, that Iran had already been reconstituting and rebuilding its arsenal and its ballistic missile capacity much, much faster than they had suspected it would be able to. And that's, of course, real concern, because as we've seen, Iran retaliates to attacks by launching these ballistic missiles at Israel. And I would note this. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. I was going to say, like, the actual, like, the June war of last year was a considerable cause of concern, because I think one reason why it was only a 12-day war was that Israel and the United States were finding that as the war progressed, Iranian missiles were getting better. That, like, you know, the initial advantage that Israel had in terms of anti-missile defense was waning, and then the Iranians we're able to get more and more of the missiles through. So this is like a, you know, like an actual strategic, like, weakness.
That's right. I mean, they were, you know, they were running out of interceptors. They were running out of, you know, the weapons they need to shoot down the Iranian missiles and other drones, etc. And I also have to say that the damage that these missiles did in Israel was not as very widely reported because of Israeli censorship. But being there in Tel Aviv, you know, I saw an entire apartment block in downtown Tel Aviv just demolished. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I spoke to, you know, Israeli colleagues, you know, one of whom just really put it vividly. He, you know, he, when those attacks came, they rushed downstairs. They were three floors below ground in a parking garage. And he said, when these things hit, you know, we're not talking about Hamas rockets. Mm-hmm. This is something different. These ballistic missiles are very, very serious. And again, you could see that, you know, in downtown Tel Aviv. So, you know, part of getting this armada in place was, again, to have those resources and the capacity to defend against that. But again, part of what Israel's concern is under Netanyahu, you know, since October 7, and this began with the Biden administration, is that, you know, Israel has, you know, previously its policy for Gaza before October 7 was what they call mowing the lawn. Now, a deeply offensive term. People are not blades of grass, but their approach was, listen, we'll keep Gaza locked up. When we see something happening that we don't like, we'll strike, we'll bomb, we'll kill some people, some civilians will be killed too, but we'll diminish the threat. We'll quote unquote restore deterrence. And then things will kind of go back to the status quo. That is how they referred to that policy. Their policy now is mowing the lawn for the entire region, whether it's Lebanon, whether it's Yemen, whether it's Syria, and now for Iran. And, you know, their problem, at least Netanyahu, as he sees it, is that if Iran is able to rebuild its defensive missile capacity, that could constrain Israel's ability to mow the lawn, which is to say that it's unacceptable for Netanyahu for Iran to have the ability to defend itself, which is an absolutely absurd, security, concept. All right. That's not, yeah, one does not have to be a fan of the Islamic regime, as I certainly am not, to say that, you know, to deny any, to simply say that this country should not have any right to self-defense is absolutely absurd. Or to just finish the point.
Or, I mean, any Iranian government. Right. let's say they became a democracy overnight tomorrow. There's no Iranian government that would ever give up, or any government of any sort anywhere in the world that would give up like a basic self-defense.
And we've also, you know, and just the final point on this, I'll put it like this. For the longest time, we've heard, you know, this kind of refrain, whenever Israel does something, whenever it strikes, Israel has the right to defend itself. But the new approach is that only Israel has the right to defend itself. Lebanon does not. Syria does not. Yemen should not. Iran must not. It's absurd on its face. And to say the least, it is not a sustainable architecture for durable regional security, which is part of the reason that so many countries, even those that have become closer to Israel, are very, very concerned about this state of affairs and oppose a new war with Iran.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's right. And I mean, it is very noticeable. I mean, you might have more thoughts on this, but, like, it does seem the sort of alliances that, you know, have long existed and were perhaps strengthened by the Arab Spring and the, you know, usefulness of Israel in providing surveillance technology and repression, the alliance between Israel and the sort of Arab autocracies, that seems to be dwindling. Yeah. And right now, I mean, from what I can see, it's only the UAE that's kind of, in Israel's corner, that, like, you know, it does seem like, you know, even like Saudi Arabia, yeah, is getting real cold feet about this. So my larger question is is even the Abraham Accords or anything like that's like possible right now, given what you're saying is Israel's policy, which is that only they have the right to defend itself.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that the Abraham Accords, I mean, the big get for the Abraham Accords was always going to be Saudi Arabia. That was the big prize, and I think that's just completely off the table now. I mean, MBS, again, not a huge fan of him, but he has been pretty clear that they cannot really consider it until there's a path forward, a real path forward for the Palestinians to end occupation and get to liberation and statehood. And of course, this Israeli government is simply not going to take any moves that way.
Yeah, I know. This has sort of been a rise of sort of, I think, very alarming Israeli comments, even farther away, like about Pakistan and Turkey, which, I mean, like, how seriously should we take that? Because I think a conflict between Israel and, like, Turkey, which right. is a NATO ally, that's right. Raises all sorts of problems.
That's putting it lightly. Yeah, but you have seen Israeli leaders like Bennett just a few weeks ago, like naming like Turkey is the new problem. They are just kind of laying the groundwork for just lots of future wars and future conflicts. And we got to be clear, the United States has no interest in this. The United States, you know, at least I think the majority of Americans are, you know, I believe that Israel should be safe from attack, but they do not believe that Israel should just, you know, with U.S., you know, that the U.S. should be subsidizing Israel's role as kind of this aggressive regional military hegemon that uses force wherever and whenever it pleases.
Yeah, I would say, like, even like within the Trump administration, like they should like be sort of like cause for concern about this. I'm thinking of, like, particularly, like, there does seem to be a commitment on the part of the Trump administration towards getting some sort of stability in Syria. Mm-hmm. And I think that, like, a lot of Israeli actions, like, undermine that. Yes. Certainly, like, Trump himself, like, you know, for reasons that are, like, more corrupt than anything else, but, like, does seem to, you know, want to stay in the good graces of Saudi Arabia and Qatar. Mm-hmm. And, having Israel bomb, like, Qatar, as they did, right. like, goes against that. So, like, do you see, like, are these fissures, do you think that they would ever have any sort of consequences? Or do you think, like, the Trump administration is pretty foursquare with Israel?
Well, I think they can have consequences. I mean, as we saw when Israel struck Qatar, that, you know, precipitated the ceasefire. I mean, that was kind of the moment that I think Qatar used pretty effectively to rally support and pressure on both on Israel and the Trump administration, more importantly, to say, listen, this is crazy. And of course, other countries, Saudi Arabia and a bit more quietly, the Emiratis, were like, yeah, we absolutely do not want a situation where Israel is free to strike our capitals, understandably. Now, I don't see it really changing dramatically, the Trump administration's approach. I don't think, honestly, Trump doesn't really care about any of this. He does, as you said, he's someone who's certainly not averse to using military force. He doesn't want to do this. He's not anti-war. He's anti-long war. And he doesn't want to get drawn into long, expensive, wasteful conflicts. He wants to do short, you know, glorious operations that he can, you know, then high five and accept everybody's praise, regardless of whether they worked or not. He will, of course, always claim that. But unless Israel does something that really draws the U.S. in, like, in a way that is completely undeniable, and this may be it, interestingly. I mean, this You know, I think as people understand that we are in this situation, you know, not only because of Israel, but in large part at this moment because of Israeli concerns, not U.S. concerns, I think that that can become a more kind of understanding among the U.S. public. But also, interestingly, there was a piece in Politico yesterday that reported that some people inside the administration, having sort of taken note of American public opposition to a new war with Iran, were suggesting, well, maybe if we could get Israel to attack first or Iran to attack and make it about Israel, then American public opinion would be more supportive, which I found bizarre in a couple ways. It's like, first of all, if you're kind of having conversations about how best to trick the American people into a war, it's probably not a great idea. Just full stop. But also, I'm skeptical that Americans generally that kind of that plays out in a way that helps Israel. You know, I actually think that undermines U.S. support for Israel if it's seen that we're only getting engaged here because of Israel.
You know, absolutely. I mean, like, you know, like, I think there's a report just this morning that, like, for the first time, a plurality of Americans support the Palestinians more than they support the Israelis. And I think that, like, you know, this Trump proposal, I guess, to have Israel strike first, then to have Iran strike Israel, and then that would be the use of a pretext for war. Like, that would actually, like, feed into the, like, larger turn of a public opinion from Israel, because it would then be the case that the United States is, undeniably, like, getting involved in this war on behalf of Israel, which is not where public opinion is, like, going, certainly among Democrats, but, like, also among, like, Republicans, like, under 40 is, like, totally going in the opposite direction. Right. Like, I think that this gets at something you said before, but maybe it was worth underscoring, which is the lack of any, like, kind of, like, rationale that they can offer for the war. Because, you know, like, as you said, they are both claiming that the June war of last year obliterated the nuclear weapons, but then the nuclear weapons are enough of an imminent threat to justify war, but also that we need to have, like, Iran strike Israel to justify it. Like, in some ways, it does seem like a reprise of 2002 to 2003.
No, I joke.
Where, like, we also need to support the protesters in Iran. Yeah. Like, it seems like there's a kind of, like, a plethora of causes. And, like, if you can't, like, offer, like, one simple top line, like, for why you need to go to war, like, that, if you have too many reasons, that's actually more worrying than if you have, like, one good reason.
Yeah. Well, no, it's like a lame cover band version of the lead up to the Iraq war, right? You've got this kind of buffet of different reasons and options and justifications. Pick one or two, whichever one tastes better to you. Is it for human rights? Is it for democracy? Is it because of nuclear weapons, weapons of mass destruction? Is it because of this, because of that? But the fact that they can't seem to land on one just tells us everything we need to know, is that this is a completely unjustified, unnecessary war, even before we get to the, you know, still important fact that it is also an illegal war.
Yeah. Yeah. Which you raised in your piece, and we'll get to just in a second. I just want to, like, on the sort of, like, rationale that they're offering, like, I have seen it suggested that there's a kind of interesting rift where people like J.D. Vance and Witkoff are emphasizing the nuclear threat, and that the sort of Marco Rubio faction is talking more about the long-range missiles. Mm-hmm. That is to say that in some ways, I mean, this might be giving Vance, like, too much credit, but, like, that Vance and Witkoff are, like, talking about the stuff that can actually be negotiated, because Iran is very willing to negotiate on nuclear policy. And in fact, they successfully negotiated with the Obama administration. And in some ways, it seems like the most, like, logical off-ramp for this war is just to, like, you know, like, redo the Obama nuclear deal.
Scratch out Obama, write Trump in big Sharpie, and I will applaud it.
Yeah. I, whereas, like, I think the Rubio to the extent that they're emphasizing the missile program, like they are actually like saying like, you know, like we have to have war.
Yeah.
Like if you're saying that the justification that, for the war is that Iran has long range missiles, well, then you're saying we have to go to war because that's not something that they're going to negotiate on.
But it's also, you know, it goes to the kind of stupidity of withdrawing from the JCPOA in the first place. Because, you know, this was a criticism that the JCPOA just dealt with the nuclear program. Which, you know, again, it was a bad faith criticism all along because it was mainly coming from people who had previously insisted that we must only focus on the nuclear program because they never actually expected Obama to get a deal. And then when he did, they started complaining, well, it doesn't encompass everything that Iran is doing. But having, you know, made this agreement and having established at least a less, you know, tense or at least having established some measure of trust between the United States and Iran, we saw an opportunity, which was unfortunately squandered, to get to those issues, right? If you remember, right at the end of Obama's presidency, there was, you know, a moment when there was a U.S. boat that was seized by the Iranian Navy with U.S. sailors taken prisoner. And that was actually resolved pretty quickly and without any fighting, any conflict, because Secretary of State John Kerry could put a call into the Iranian foreign minister. That is a direct result of the diplomacy that was done around the JCPOA. That made Americans safer. That had created some at least channel between the two countries that could have been expanded to address all the other issues that these people are talking about. And yet that opportunity was completely destroyed by withdrawing from the JCPOA and showing Iran that, no, in fact, you cannot trust the United States.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is the kind of, you know, like original sin. Oh, I will also mention, and, you know, there's a third presidency that could have had a factor, which is, I mean, I think one of the real failures of the Biden administration was that they did not take up, you know, like go forcefully enough to renegotiate.
You know, he broke one of his most unequivocal promises in foreign policy. He wrote a piece in October of 2020. You know, who knows if he wrote it? He probably didn't even write it, but it was under Joe Biden's name, where he said, this is what I'm going to do. And then he didn't do it. You know, so he came to office. And again, the Iranians were saying, well, listen, we've been burned. This previous president withdrew from this deal. Can we trust this new president? And Joe Biden showed them, no, in fact, you cannot trust this new president.
Yeah. This is like a little tangential, but I mean, I do think that the two big crises that we have now are interestingly rooted in Biden's unwillingness to take up Obama's foreign policy. Mm-hmm. One, you know, as you mentioned, is the Iran nuclear deal. The other is Cuba.
That's right.
We can return to
that. I just want to pause on that for a minute because, these were two areas where Obama, you know, very courageously took on the Washington foreign policy establishment. Because, I mean, the foreign policy establishment has sustained these absolutely absurd, you know, conflicts, you know, with Cuba even longer than with Iran.
Yeah.
And again, that's not to absolve either of those countries for their own rule, their own corruption, their own repression. But like the idea that we can't, you know, try to do diplomacy and try to create better relations between these two countries is just kind of an article of religious faith in the foreign policy establishment. Obama was right to challenge it. He was right to do what he did. And Biden, as a creature of that old thinking, it was an enormous failure for him to not pick up the ball there.
No. So in our sort of current moment, I mean, like I said, I think you've sort of compellingly laid out, you know, like this war does not make a lot of sense from American interest and could like go like very badly, even in like sort of Trump's own terms. If he wants a sort of splendid little war, well, you know, the Pentagon has told him we can't guarantee that. Like you know, this is like a formidable power that, you know, like in the last war that we had, just like last year, did actually like, you know, do serious damage to like an American ally and could do damage to American troops. So with all the sort of problems of the war, and it's also, unlike 2002 to 2003, there's not a lot of sort of jingoistic flag waving that's supporting this push towards war. And in fact, like all the public opinion polls show, this is like massively unpopular, like certainly with Democratic voters, independent voters, but also with Republican voters. Like there's no like mass constituency for going to war with Iran right now. Yeah. And then I have to say the Trump administration has done, like, you know, like, is much worse than the Bush administration in sort of, like, you know, rolling out the war and doing a public relations campaign. They have not been successful. So one would think that given all that, like, you know, like, there would be an opposition party, if it existed,
would take up
the mantle and then, like, be pressing on, you know, an issue where they'd have public opinion on their side, as well as, like, it being the right policy course. So where are the Democrats right now?
Well, I would say
this is something you talk about. I'll link to it, but you have a piece of foreign policy which goes into this in some detail. Where are they right now?
Right. Well, so again, you can say there are a number of great Democrats who have been or are generally good on foreign policy and are taking the lead here. In the House, you have Ro Khanna, who has introduced, along with his Republican colleague Thomas Massie, a war powers resolution, you know, stating the president does not have authorization to go into war. In the Senate, there is Senator Tim Kaine, along with Republican Rand Paul, have offered a Senate version of that. You've got a number of others. I mean, obviously, Bernie is great on this. AOC has been great on this. Others who are just, you know, over the past few weeks have really started to come out more forcefully. So I would say in terms of the rank and file, you know, on the Hill, it's better than it has been in the past. Having worked on these issues in Washington for almost 20 years, you know, God help me. I would say that there are more, you know, strongly anti-war voices who are willing to engage in this than there ever have been, at least since I've been here. But the leadership still remains, you know, locked into this kind of nostalgic, kind of neoliberal post-Cold War, post-9/11 moment where they're just so afraid of taking a strong anti-war position, despite, as you said, the overwhelming evidence that Americans are against this. Democrats and independents are overwhelmingly against this. And the fact that there is simply no question that this is a responsible administration that is going to use American power responsibly. We have all the evidence we need on this. And I would add to that, you know, you also have a Democratic foreign policy establishment that remains largely, you know, in the hands of kind of hawkish think tanks, hawkish donors, just very conservative, very cautious, you know, even for, you know, foreign administration people, kind of the, you know, the foreign policy expert class. You can find some people who are coming out against my friend Andrew Miller at the Center for American Progress. One example just published a piece today, you know, making clear that this is a bad idea, which I appreciate that, especially coming from CAP, where I used to work, which is not known for taking courageous stands on foreign policy. But, you know, there's also a problem of, you know, a lot of folks who have been in previous administrations very much want to work in future administrations. And their instincts are to just kind of keep your head down. Don't get out there against this. If you're going to offer any thoughts or analysis, just do so in a very kind of here's, you know, strategically this, that, we don't know this. You know, they're just not willing to come out and oppose this, which they absolutely should. So, I mean, I guess one of the arguments of my piece is like, listen, it is just it's far past time that the Democrats need a leadership that reflects the actual voters of the party. And I've said this before, I'll be saying it into the future, but I mean, we are just saddled with a congressional leadership who, even if they now support finally the war powers resolution, which is good. And that is actually credit to a lot of outside groups that have been putting pressure on members, putting pressure on the leadership. It's a credit to a lot of the members themselves, senators and representatives, who have been putting pressure on the leadership to come out in support of these resolutions. But the amount of time and energy it takes to get the, you know, congressional leaders, Democratic congressional leaders, to the right place, it just shouldn't take this much work.
Yeah, no. I mean, like, it is actually, like, quite striking. And I will have to also say, like, I think your piece brings out the fact that a lot of the objections that they're making are, like, simply sort of, like, pragmatic ones, or they're trying to, like, have the very narrow sort of, like, a critique rather than, like, you know, like, asking the broader questions. Because I do think, like, you know, like, if the United States for, you know, the third time in the last like 30 years is heading towards, or the last 40 years is heading towards like a big, you know, like Middle Eastern war, then like, you know, it is a responsibility of Congress to like ask what's going on and to debate out, to lay out the case, pro and con for this. And the sort of evasiveness is really striking.
Right. And, you know, as I note in the piece, I mean, you know, even some Democrats who are willing to say, who are willing to question this, one thing you really see is like, Donald Trump hasn't shared his strategy with us. Tell us, we need to hear from Donald Trump what his plan is. Like, this is not a mystery, okay? This is not Sherlock Holmes and the case of the missing casus belli, okay? This is not something that's going to be explained to you. It is obvious that this is a bad idea. You don't need a briefing. You would need courage to come out and oppose this.
Yeah, no. I absolutely. Like, where do you think, I mean, one thing I've been sort of struck by, like, just not just now, but over the last decade, is this whole issue of the sort of like imperial presidency and the way in which, you know, Trump has taken advantage of the fact that the president is given huge amount of leeway on issues of sort of like national security. And what it seems like all the kind of like problems with that, like not just abroad, but like, you know, like domestically, like, when, you know, like the sort of attacks on immigrants is coming from a sort of all the rationales of the global war on terror. I mean, like they're basically using that sort of framework for domestic repression. Right. Like, one would think in that case, you know, like that there would be a larger, more systematic question, like, you know, like, you know, is the imperial presidency like worth it? Can we like push this back? Yeah. Can we like, you know, recover what are actually the, you know, constitutional powers that Congress has for both for declaring war and for like more, I think even equally importantly, oversight, like in foreign policy decisions, is there like any sort of like constituency, or is there any like movement on that front among the Democrats?
I mean, I think there is. I mean, I think there are members, and again, when I worked with Bernie, this was part of the logic behind the War Powers Resolution on Yemen that we worked to pass. That
Congress, which is successful.
It was successful. The first War Powers Resolution in history passed, and then, you know, Trump vetoed it, and Congress did not have the enough in the Senate to overturn that veto. But still, I think an important exercise, an effort to kind of get, you know, the constitutional muscles working again. But really, you're not going to be able to write this or reverse it or arrest it or change it until you have a president that is committed to doing it. And we have now had two Democratic presidents, Obama and Biden, who I think refuse to do what I think is necessary to really dismantle these tools that were erected, especially after 9/11, but for a long time, even before 9/11, you know, different presidencies, you know, you get to that seat, you get to the Oval Office, you sit behind that desk and you're like, wow, what amazing power I have. And, you know, any person would be disinclined to divest themselves of this power and these tools. But we really need a president who is committed to doing that. You know, Obama and Biden, you know, didn't do it both for reasons of pragmatism and ideology. For Biden, very much the latter. For Obama, probably more the former. Just like it will take effort, it will take time, it will take expending considerable political capital to really kind of reform the way that the executive branch uses force, the tools and procedures that they apply, and giving that power back to Congress. Now, you know, again, going back to my time on the Hill in 2021, you know, Senator Sanders, Senator Murphy, and Senator Mike Lee co-sponsored the National Security Powers Act, which did these things. It kind of rewrote the War Powers Act. It dealt with the issue of emergency declarations and sanctions. It was a pretty big, and if I do say so myself, a pretty impressive bill written with a lot of experts' input, a lot of outside groups' expert input, that attempted to start the process of how Congress could take back these authorities and constrain, you know, the executive in matters of war, as the framers of the Constitution, I think, clearly intended. So that bill is still there. I know there's been some interest on the part of other members of Congress in taking it either in whole or in part. But what we really need is for a president to, you know, a president who is committed to doing it.
Yeah. Yeah, 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 yeah. No, I mean, in terms of, I think it applies more broadly in terms of policy that, like, especially among Democrats, like, the usual path for, like, substantial constitutional change is to have, you know, both the president and the House, like, on board, mm-hmm. and a president that exercises leadership, but then also, like, a House that's willing to sort of support mm-hmm. it. And, I mean, that's a real possibility, like, you know, depending on how the elections go and in the sort of future. That we only have a little bit of time left, but, I mean, I think this opens up, you know, this something I know that you're very concerned about, which is, like, what sort of foreign policy should Democrats have. And there is a kind of school of thought that, you know, if one wants to give it credit, like, it's sort of based on the idea, well, what voters care about is domestic issues, and we need to be talking about, like, healthcare and economics and not foreign policy. And I know you don't share that line of thought. Like, so what would be your critique to the people who are saying, like, the focus should be on bread and butter issues. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, if one wanted to give them the maximum amount of credit, I do actually think that is what is guiding Chuck Schumer and Hakeem Jeffries, their belief that, like, this is the way to win elections and to gain power and to, like, you know, thwart Trumpism.
Yeah, well,
what would be your response to that?
I mean, I don't necessarily disagree that most people, Americans or not, just are more focused on the immediate issues. I mean, the cost of food, the cost of housing, are their children healthy, are their families healthy, are their communities healthy and safe? And, you know, kind of less, you know, spending less time thinking and worrying about what's happening in other parts of the world. But I think there is, you know, we do have evidence that Americans are against these just endless wars. They have real questions about the amount of money and time and resources that their government is spending abroad. We have the whole NATO discussion. Trump tapped into that, but not only Trump, Obama, even before him, was saying, listen, NATO partners need to invest more. We can't be doing this much. And as I think a really important kind of data point that I bring up a lot is that in every election since the end of the Cold War, with the one exception of 2004, the more anti-war candidate has won. The candidate who promised a more kind of humble, more restrained foreign policy won. Now, I'm not going to pretend that that is why they won in all of these cases, but I do think that's a very interesting set of data at this point. At the very least, it suggests that even if, you know, voters are not, they don't have foreign policy top of mind, there's actually a large constituency that would support a more anti-war foreign policy. There's a lot more political space to offer a less militaristic approach to the world, but Democrats continue, you know, they seem to be dominated by this, we don't need to talk about foreign policy, let's just kind of talk about our lethal military and make sure we check the box so that we can talk about these other things. Like, yeah, those other things are important, but I do think, you know, there's far more space to offer a new vision for America's role in the world then I think Democrats in general, especially the Democratic foreign policy establishment, has been really willing to think about, because they're completely trained in this old way of, you know, this kind of, if not the Cold War, then the post-Cold War unipolar moment where America gets up in everybody's business. As former Secretary of State Blinken said, you know, if America's not there setting the rules, then maybe no one will, and then it's chaos. It's like, that thinking is over. I mean, it's a new world, so I don't think Americans want to withdraw from the world. I've never believed in that. I think the polling shows that they believe America should remain very, you know, kind of robustly engaged. But the question is, how do we engage? What tools do we use? And you know, I think that the time is right for Democratic leaders, a Democratic candidate for president, maybe even more than one, to say, listen, here's a new approach. America believes in peace. We believe in coexistence. This is a better way to keep Americans safe and prosperous than launching wars and interventions all over the world.
Yeah. And I mean, to that all, I would also add the extent that like any president is seen as like, you know, like being heavily invested in war and like, you know, like, and then, you know, keeping American primacy. Like, I think that actually hurts the domestic agenda, because I think people, even to the extent that people want presidents to be concerned about domestic policy, the fact that, you know, you're going around as Joe Biden was, you know, say, talking about AUKUS and NATO and expending huge amounts of political capital and supporting the war in Gaza, like that actually, like, you know, hurts you. And I actually think Trump is actually hurt by the fact that, like, he has now decided that foreign policy is where he's going to flex his muscle. I totally agree.
Again, he ran in 2024, as he did in 2016, as an anti-war president, as a pro-peace president. He has clearly broken that promise, and I think he is paying a price.
Yeah. No, I think that there's a lot of avenue for making an argument, and it's actually interesting. Even like back in the 1990s, the idea of American primacy was always more of an elite fixation than a popular one. Like, you know, like more broadly, Americans have always supported a kind of like multilateral policy, where the U.S. is an important world player, but, like, you know, not the world's policeman. Yeah. And that's actually something, you know, as one is seeing from, you know, the response to Mark Carney's speech in at Davos, that, you know, the way American allies are increasingly thinking as well. So I think there's a real, like, openings there.
Yeah, agree.
Yeah. So we've covered a lot of ground. Hopefully wiser heads will prevail. But if not, there's certainly room for organizing and for political opposition. Yes. I want to thank Matt once again for being on the program. And as I mentioned before, we'll link to his article, which I think clarifies the political debates on this issue of the moment.
Thank you, Gene. Always great to be with you.
You know that goal you set at the start of the year? You can still do it, whether you're committed to a thru-hike with friends, lifting heavier, or simply walking more. It's not too late to stick with it and make your future self proud, especially with the all-in-one nutrition shake from Ka'Chava. Because quality nutrition shouldn't be complicated. Just 2 scoops of Ka'Chava's all-in-one nutrition shake, and you've got 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, adaptogens, and so much more. Plus, it actually tastes delicious. No fillers, no nonsense. Just the good stuff your body craves. So instead of adding to your backstock of supplements that overpromise and underdeliver, simplify your progress with just 2 scoops of the highest quality ingredients. Stick with your wellness goals. Go to kachava.com and use code FITNESS for 15% off. That's kachava.com and use code FITNESS. KACHAVA.com code FITNESS.